I am your host, the Doc Chad Matthews, lordsofpain.net. Wherever you may be listening, Doc says.
This is just what the doc ordered. I'm saying welcome. They sick of the other shows. Chad here to help them. The author of the mania era is bringing terror on. This is the preparer for the knowledge that he about to showcase. Like a bar that you lift, his opinions hold weight. He wrote a few books and he's working on another for y'all. This a 5-star podcast, Chad, let's get it on.
Author of the WrestleMania era, the book of sports entertainment and of the doctor's orders on lordsofpain.net. Doc says. All right, so let's talk about Triple H for a second then. Because I definitely get the vibe that you think that Triple H is maybe not an undisputed number one, and I think that's tough. Personally, I think I know that there's always going to be a lot of baggage with him.
I do think he's a number one, okay. Right? However, he's standing on shaky ground. At almost any, you know, way you want to measure it. Do you want to call him the biggest draw? No, because he wrestled all the people that have the biggest draws. You want to call him the best wrestler? No, he didn't start having great WrestleMania matches till he was like a part-timer. Damn near.
No, that's true. That's absolutely true. That's undisputed outside of the WrestleMania 20 main event.
Yeah. And it's like, do people love him like that? No, they don't love him like that either. He's had to literally remake his image into Uncle Paul of NXT to hope people forgot about everything he caused last decade. However, you cannot argue with how good of a talker he is, how good of a heel he was for how long he was a heel. I think there's an argument for him to be the best heel ever in WWE. And I don't think, for me, it doesn't impact what I think of him, but, you know, people would always bring up, you know, the marrying into the family thing and stuff like that. But, I mean, the guy already made it to the top before that already happened. For me, that was never really a big thing to judge him on.
Yeah. And I don't even think that the period that usually got held against him, the 2002 through 2005 era, I wouldn't even really hold that against him. Like a lot of people like to cite him as being somewhat of a failure because everybody bolted and wrestling became not as popular naturally because it stopped being what it was. There was a certain run that the Attitude Era peak was always going to have, and it just, you know, for reasons that didn't have a whole lot of to do with Triple H, it sort of fizzled out, and he was the guy left standing and having to carry the brand. But I look back on it now more than ever as you know, that era where he was on top and building Evolution and ultimately having the match at WrestleMania 20, the build-up to the match at WrestleMania 21 with Batista, I loved. You know, there were moments where he, you know, he got out the shovel, but there were moments when he did exactly what a top guy needed to do. And, you know, I look back at that fondly. So Triple H is safe in the number one spot for me.
A career of complication where if you start examining it, there are warts there, but I think he has a robust legacy and enough of a varied legacy to where it's like, all right, if you give me three things that are warts, I can give you five that are, you know, that actually makes sense. Like if you look at his WrestleMania record, he should have lost even more. And the testament that he lost that much, I think is actually a point for him.
Yeah, indeed. I think he,
for being a career heel like that, you should lose at the end.
he put over guys who, you know, I mean, you know, I think there's certainly an argument to be made for putting Booker T over at WrestleMania 19. But I mean, the three WrestleManias thereafter were closed by him tapping out or laying up there looking at the lights. So, you know, that does matter to me in that conversation. Well, let's kind of move on to some of the more modern wrestlers, because that's one of the things that I want to close our conversation about with legacy and where things are going, is I want you to first explain the concept here of being a franchise guy, because now that we're going to start getting outside the realm of the guys who I think had to be number one undisputed guys to get into the type of top 10 conversation that we're recontextualizing and having right now. Better explain that concept to people, borrowing off of the pro basketball analogy that brought it forth.
Sure. So basketball has the least amount of players on a team at the same time playing. You have five players on the court. So in theory, the best player can swing, you know, the variables and the impact on the game a lot. He can impose his will a little bit easier than it would be able to in football. Like, it's not, you know, if you're the tight end, it's going to be tough for you to completely, you know, dominate the game, you know, because you may not even touch the ball on certain possessions, right? But in basketball, you know, and then relating it back to pro wrestling, look at someone how Gato books in New Japan. There's obviously a big four, and if you're one of those four guys, obviously there's a hierarchy in that four itself, but there's like this golden kind of zone where, you know, guys struggle to break through, like a Sonata's like knocking at the door, like, will you let me in the club up there, please? Like AJ Styles was once in that big four. Nakamura was once in that big four. When they left, Naito and Kenny assumed that right there. And now you're seeing the big four that's in the Wrestle Kingdom tournament, like Okada, Bushi, White, Naito, with someone like a Will Ospreay, like just about to literally like kick the door down the second Wrestle Kingdom is over. And that's kind of what, you know, like, and usually, and back to basketball, if you have that number one player, you know, a guy like that, okay, you have a chance to win. Now, if you have a guy that fills the role as the number two, you have a really good chance to win. And now if you have the third guy that goes with those other two, oh, you're probably going to win a title. Like, so, and I think Chad, what he's gearing up to ask me, or he has a list of guys prepared, do any of these people fit in that one slot, that two slot, or the three slot, or maybe they're like lower than that possibly?
And we can certainly relate them to WrestleMania era stars to help contextualize it for you. One of the guys I'd like to serve as an example of context that I think we need to establish, now that we've established a number one, a lower tier number one, who in your mind is a great number two? Like, are we talking about Shawn Michaels as the ideal number two? Are we talking about Undertaker?
I think
these are great number
twos. I think
twos.
I'm talking about Undertaker and Shawn Michaels, because if
Mick
you
Foley.
Look at, you know, Mick Foley, you look at their runs, you know, if they were on top like that, right? And that was, you know, you fell back on them in hard times. Like, you put The Undertaker on SmackDown, and he can always wrestle for the title if you need him to, but he's not the person that's, you know, going to be that for you. Shawn Michaels, he's going to give you the great matches on, you know, random pay-per-views to supplement your whoever your champion is. Those are perfect examples of number two guys.
All right, so another guy I'd like to use as an example of context for the rest of our conversation about these more modern stars. What do you think about Edge? You brought him up earlier. I have him really highly ranked based on career accomplishment primarily. You know, redefined tag team wrestling in WWE for a period of time that really serves as the peak of tag team wrestling in this century thus far in the TLC era. Highly decorated single star, won every championship, was in a championship match for four straight WrestleManias. Really not ever on the Batista or John Cena level of star, probably right alongside in that era with Randy Orton as the secondary guys. Randy Orton would be another interesting one to discuss. But Edge, I think of him as a guy who belongs in the conversation as a number two. But I get the sense that you would say maybe he's best suited, your product's most successful, if he's your number three.
See, I think you could moonlight him between both of those. If you have him as a number three, you're probably going to win the title. Like if you have that guy there, like, and also another way to think about this, if you have three big matches on the card, what's the third match? What's the semi-main? What's the main event? What match are they in? So if Edge is in your third match and you have 2006, 2007, 2008 Edge, that dick mastermind heel that he had, if he's your third match, oh yeah, semi-main event and then main event, those matches are usually going to be pretty good, right? Be like, oh, okay, I have a really good card here that can potentially be great. He could be either one of those. I think he probably works best as a three. Like, that's where it's like, yes, like, I got something great here. And then if you got him at two, it's like, might be a struggle, but you know, we might still get something good here. I think he can be a mid tier two.
Fair enough. Now, bear in mind, Edge was in the main event of the best WrestleMania of that era. Let's talk about Orton quickly. Is he a two?
No.
Okay. Is he a three?
Randy Orton is not a two. Randy Orton is a three. Randy Orton's a three.
What is Kurt Angle?
Oh man, I would probably say Kurt Angle is as versatile as Chris Jericho was.
He's a two, though, right? I mean, he's
he would definitely be a two, I would think, because like you can look at places he's moved business. You can look at his in-ring legacy. You can look at his versatility, and he's definitely a two.
All right, so the way I'm starting to think of this, translating it to wrestling, is that your ones are your undisputed top guys. Your twos are your guys who can step into headlining spots quite easily, even at the biggest show of the year, even in the main event, like Jericho did as of 0-2. He's not a number one. So 0-2, Jericho steps into that spot. Edge in 2008 steps into that spot. All right, so who is your quintessential? Because what I'm starting to think of now with the number threes are the guys that regularly round out your top five guys in the company. They're not number one, two, or three, but they're regularly in the conversation for four or five. So who's your quintessential guy who represents that? I'll throw a couple of names at you that are highly rated in the WrestleMania era book. And give me a number, just to put it into context, so when we start talking about these modern wrestlers, trying to put them into context, people have got a wrestling connection to go to. Let's talk about Sting.
I think Sting's a solid number three.
Okay. Let's talk about Kevin Nash.
I think Kevin Nash he's knocking on the door of being a number three.
Okay.
So, like, Kevin Nash could be he could be your first big off the bench.
Gotcha. Sorry. So you're not looking at him as a so-called starter, not a guy who, you know, even though he's got the history there. I mean, WCW, the NWO, the whole thing there. I mean, he's got that supporting his resume. He's also got the failed run as WWE champion working against his resume. So not really thinking of him as a three, though.
I get, with Nash, if I take him out of that time, right, and import him into another one, like say I put him in 2007, right, and he comes along and he doesn't have like the click, like so much of it is kind of tied on like his friends within the business. It's weird.
It's true.
Like with Nash. So it would be interesting to see what he could do on his own merit, because there's always room for a well-spoken, good-looking 7-foot guy that is fucking jacked. Yeah. Like, I mean, I think he does well in any era, but like, so what's the difference between him and a Sid who's like 90% as good as him?
I think the only thing would be the more natural – well, I don't know. The charisma is just different. Sid had some sort of a magnetism about him, didn't he? Yeah. That's a good point.
Yes.
And then all the same things you can say about X-Pac, who's in the top – you know, he's in that sort of third tier of the WrestleMania era, sitting back in like the mid-70s in the rankings. Mm-hmm. Most of it's because of his friends. You can say the same thing about Kevin Nash, and he's ranked in the top 25. Let's see.
Someone like X-Pac, you brought him up, just snuck him in there real quick. I think he would be a perfect example for like your Lou Williams off the bench, maybe. If you have that guy as your seventh man,
player.
Oh, you're in wonderful condition.
Absolutely. Okay, and I think if you're up for it, we need to contextualize that too. We need to get, I know we're getting a little long here, but this is the final episode of the Doc Says. So if you've got the time, let's keep going.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, man.
All right. So focusing on threes, then, we still don't have the perfect quintessential number three. What about Ricky Steamboat?
I would probably put him in at a three. he can wrestle anybody. I can say
always
that.
Always going to be over.
Always going to be over. Always going to be beloved. I think Ricky Steamboat is a really interesting, if he's your second guy, I think he can moonlight as a number two.
So that was what I was thinking. So again, I still don't think of him as the perfect three. How about,
If I have a John Cena, I would definitely like a Ricky Steamboat. Like,
yeah.
Like for all my heels to go through to get to John Cena.
Okay. What about Eddie Guerrero? Because that's the name that first came to mind. To me, he's the perfect number three. Because I mean, he's awesome at everything he does, and he can moonlight as a headliner. But I think he's better suited to, have a couple of peaks. And here's the thing: you take away his untimely death, he's getting his second peak. That's going to happen. That's in the works. That's the creative plan. They say is that. His second peak was happening right at that time. And yeah. So because of that, maybe you could argue he's still a number two.
I would put him as a number two. And I feel confident in saying, like, say Eddie Guerrero doesn't die. He's 38 years old in 2005. Okay. Maybe he goes until he's 44 years old. Maybe he holds on to get to, like, WrestleMania 28. Okay. And maybe that's the end of the road for him. Are we talking about, what, one of the 25 greatest guys ever at that rate in the trajectory he was going, and maybe his body holds up a little better if we can get him off the, the performance enhancing stuff and, everything like that. He, with his death, he's one of the greatest, most talented guys that's ever entered the sport. As early back as 1997, people were saying this about Guerrero. So
to me, because his peak was about 8 years long, take a couple of years away, I think he's still, he's still rated in the top 25 in the WrestleMania era right now. And even without that dynamic, if he has five more years to pad his stats, so to speak, then Eddie Guerrero goes down as, top 20, he's in, I think he starts pushing into that category like a Kurt Angle or somebody like that, who just was really tremendous at his job for a really long time. Tremendous at his job for a peak period at a very high level. Because I guess Kurt Angle, I'm thinking of the TNA stuff that I watched, because Kurt Angle was really having some barn burners in TNA, even though, how we can...
Front flipping off the stage, belovedly known as Perk Angle.
I don't know how we contextualize Impact, but that's for another day. Or maybe it's another day. It's another day for you and James to figure that out. Okay, so let's figure out who number three is, because right now we're getting into the back part of what I have as the top 30. So the first tier all time of WrestleMania era stars. We haven't figured out necessarily. I guess you're saying Sting is a three, so that that stands out. What about what about Ted DiBiase?
Definitely a three.
I agree. That one makes definitely sense to me.
and I look at that because, he is the okay. If you had to do it like they were Mortal Kombat mountains that you had to go through, and there's a lower ranked version of each guy, right? This is gonna sound crazy. I'm gonna say this. He's like, and it's, of course, it's fitting because it's the Million Dollar Man, but he's a millionaire's Miz, essentially. Like, so I think the highest you can be, like Miz was at his time, I think he would, for the 2010s, like, he could be like a three. Uh-huh. Like, DiBiase is somebody that could have been, with the IC title, he could have had it a long time. They just never did it for whatever reason. But I think he's a three for sure. If you got a Million Dollar Man flanking a two and a one that's on their jobs, you're winning the title.
All right, here, let's throw a couple of names into rapid fire succession, and then we'll get into the current guys. And along the way, I guess, figure out where others belong and draw some historical parallels as well. But Rob Van Dam.
I think Rob Van Dam's a three also.
Kurt Hennig, Mr. Perfect.
I think Mr. Perfect is a three.
Rick Rude.
Rick Rude is a sixth man. Okay.
And how are we defining that in this kind of context?
So I don't think he's not going to be in your top three matches. He's going to be.
Even though he was.
Maybe.
At a peak
era.
Yeah.
Maybe it's the longevity with Rude. Maybe it's like him getting injured at the wrong time.
That's true. Hennig was that way too.
I don't see. He was, but I think he had a higher like in ring peak, championship peak.
Hennig never main evented a pay per view.
He didn't.
Rude did. He main evented SummerSlam.
Rude did.
Basically, the Ultimate Warrior's greatest rival.
That's a good one. Did he do anything as great as Mr. Perfect, though?
No, I suppose not. I mean, the peak that, you know, the Perfect and Bret Hart in-ring component is hard to ignore.
Yeah. I would probably say Rude. Maybe he can knock on the door. He can start sometimes for you, but I'm putting him as a sixth man.
Okay, fair enough. Now, in this analogy, is he like a number four, or are we talking about literally there's a tier of six different guys, and he falls all the way back to six?
So I'm thinking of it like you've got two other guys in the starting lineup that kind of just fill out the starters, but in order
crunch
to
time.
Like maximize your rotation, like maybe he's in there with them at crunch time,
Manu.
But I'm going to bring him off the bench like a Manu Ginobili just to like, you know, to spell the starters.
Okay, gotcha. I'm with you. All right, fair enough. Okay. Well, let's start transitioning into this current era, because I think there's some interesting conversations to have around some guys that are in WWE and some guys that aren't. But let's start with a cracker. Let's start with Roman Reigns. Roman Reigns,
yeah,
he who helps define this era of pro wrestling in WWE, because, you know, he's accomplished a lot. There's only one other guy in history who has main evented four consecutive WrestleManias. Now, he does not have that classic resume of a guy who wins the championship and holds it throughout the year like a John Cena did. He doesn't have that. It's not a part of his resume. And I don't know how we contextualize that against his WrestleMania main event track record, considering that also a part of his WrestleMania track record is that three of those four main events were the worst WrestleMania main events ever. So, you know.
And nobody wanted them to have
and
them.
So they weren't even main events in the traditional sense, because only really, and none of them were really matches that people wanted them to have, but at least in 2015, there was an argument to be made for it. An argument that I made.
Mm-hmm.
I did. I mean, I look back at it. I was saying at that time, you know what? Push forward. Because pushing forward means he becomes John Cena, but he just didn't become John Cena, so now I can't support it that way. So Roman Reigns, to me, has never really defined top guy in WWE, except for the fact that that's the label that he's been given. And there's a difference between having the label and having earned the label. And that's not to take anything away from him. It's not to take anything away from what he's accomplished, but if you're trying to tell me that Roman Reigns belongs in the same category as Dave Bautista right now, I'm not buying it. I'm not putting those guys on the same level. I'm not putting Roman Reigns in the same classification as, even an Edge. Because Edge has accomplished way more. He's more important to the overall picture of the last decade. In terms of what he accomplished and what he meant to the product. I mean, Edge was a glue guy. Edge was like a he's Dennis Johnson on the 80s Celtics. I mean, he's that kind of player. What's Roman Reigns to you? But he has to be a two, doesn't he?
I think Roman, yeah. It's like he can't be a one. That's what I'm saying. Like,
there's no argument to be made that he's a one. Literally.
Yeah, there's none. Like, there's none that I would hear from anyone. I'm like, all right, I think Roman Reigns should have been a one.
No question.
There's no question he should have been a number one, right? But
he's not.
He's not. it just flat out comes out to he just was not the guy that the fans picked, and ultimately we're the ones that are doing this thing. And it's not I feel like you have to willfully ignore context with Roman Reigns to try to push him up to a one status. You would willfully have to not acknowledge WrestleMania main events getting hijacked over and over and over again. You would willfully have to acknowledge the fact that there were other guys that literally could have been plugged into this position and nothing would have changed financially in the company. You would willfully have to ignore context to think that, you know, to realize that a WrestleMania came and went this year without him really factoring into any type of drawing position and nothing like, and they had, it was still financially successful, everything like that. You would have to like completely ignore all that, which WWE asked you to do a lot, right? But I would, for all the things Roman is not, there are a lot of things that he is. He is a one of the better heavyweight workers that WWE's ever had, right? He does have a fair share of loyal fans that will support him and advocate for him loudly on Twitter. Like, you've seen them, I've seen them. They are there. But there's not an, like, it's far too late. Like, his history, a lot of it's already written. Roman Reigns, I think he's maybe 34 years old. So I don't know. I know he re-signed another contract, so maybe he has like another, you know, 10 years in front of him. Who knows? And he'll get a chance to eventually grow into, I think James had mentioned it, maybe he can become what John Cena was in 2015, but smack dab in the middle of his prime rather than
at the end of it.
You know, at that very end, like, because there's enough wrestlers around to do that stuff with him. But WWE handles him in a fashion where they never know what to do with him at any point in time. Like, right now, he's wrestling Baron Corbin tomorrow, Chad. Why is that happening? Why is he not wrestling a good worker like an Andrade? Why is he not having barn burners? So by the time it's time to plug him back into that WrestleMania season, which is going to happen, by the way, I'm calling it now. When it's time to plug him in, he's hot to everyone. Like, it's, I don't understand it. They're doing all these gymnastics to not get him booed, and they're putting him in there with safe opponents. Everything they do with Roman Reigns is like, it really makes it hard in a way how it's hard to judge Kevin Nash, kind of, because of his association with his friends. A lot of the protective booking that Roman Reigns has received and manufactured accolades, and I know none of it's real, so don't come at me with that, anyone on Twitter. Like, the manufactured accolades, the four WrestleMania main events in a row, it's like, it wasn't supposed to be you. It was supposed to be CM Punk. It was supposed to be Daniel Bryan. It was supposed to be AJ Styles. It was supposed to be every one of these guys kind of rotating this thing, it feels like.
Go with the one that got the hottest. He was never the hottest at WrestleMania time. At least never in the way they were trying to present him.
Correct. And I think he falls in as a three, right? Like, his walking around every day is a three. But I think if you ask him to be a number two, he can definitely be a number two.
I agree. I think the two names that come to mind for historical parallels for where I see Roman Reigns going and where Roman Reigns is right now, he feels a lot more to me, like if we were looking at the 90s, he feels a lot more to me like someone who's better suited to play the Undertaker's role. You know, that, you know, you called him, you called Undertaker. What was the thing you called him and Shawn Michaels? The, I can't remember what you,
quintessential number two support for the champion.
Yeah, essentially. And you came up with a great expression for them. Like the luxury thing, the greatest,
Expensive luxury.
That's Roman Reigns right now. That's one thing that comes to mind. The other is Randy Orton, because he's very similar in the way that he's supposed to be one thing. It didn't work out. And now we're kind of just waiting for Roman Reigns to have his peak. And he hasn't had it yet. You know, it's weird that a guy with that many accomplishments and that's been in the spotlight for 5 years, you know, 5 years now. 6 years, almost. We're going into year six. We're in year six of of Roman Reigns as a top level star at the main event level, and I couldn't say that he's had a peak yet. Like, what's his peak? Is his peak that brief?
Funny thing with Roman Reigns. Funny thing with Roman Reigns. Now, if you take away those things, it's like, what is Roman Reigns really? If you take away those four like main events, right, and then you juxtaposition it with like Chris Jericho, right? That WrestleMania main event didn't end up defining him because he has this robust legacy elsewhere. Roman Reigns, they've so strictly tied his legacy and identity to those four WrestleMania main events. It doesn't feel like there's these other moments that really resonate. You know, there's the Shield, but ultimately it's a mid-card faction, you know, in the grand scheme of things.
6 months.
Right.
That's it.
So it's weird, like, when you start thinking about Roman Reigns, and I think we may have had a talk when originally he had the cancer diagnosis, and it's like, well, how do you contextualize this guy? And Roman Reigns, there's a larger conversation to be had that we, I think, kind of had earlier in the show about what WWE is now in it being overexposed, in it being not the way it used to be, where you can easily contextualize these guys. It's like, you're going to be arguing with a lot of heart if you're a big Roman Reigns supporter and you're listening to this. You're arguing with a lot more of your heart into this rather than any established standard that that exists. Absolutely. Throughout the rest of history.
Absolutely. It's fascinating. Roman Reigns is just weird historically. I don't, you know, because to me, I think, didn't we say Randy Orton's a three? Okay.
Yeah.
So, I mean, to me, that's the better parallel. I mean, that's the best parallel right now. We're talking about, you know, Randy Orton's peak moment was with Mick Foley before he ever became a headliner. Roman Reigns' peak moment was with The Shield before he ever became a headliner. Those are the things I remember those two guys for the most in terms of what they actually accomplished in a creative position to express the best versions of themselves on the 20 by 20 foot canvas. That's not the makings of a number two guy. You know what I mean? That's a number three guy. You can absolutely make for a great product with Roman Reigns as your third best guy. But I don't think you can make a case for him there is no case for number one. And I think you'd struggle to make a realistic case about number two. And I know that we're going to catch some flack for that. There's one person in particular who I think we'll catch it from. But, you know, bottom line is, you know, Roman Reigns should be way more than he is. And at this point, I don't know that he's ever going to get the creative opportunity to be what he could be. And that's the part that's probably the most frustrating thing as a lapsed WWE fan, is that how can I go in and watch a product and invest in a product that someone like Roman Reigns, Rich Latta, Roman Reigns, who has main evented four straight WrestleManias at a point at his career, how can we not be confident that he's going to have the opportunity to maximize his career creatively and watch the product that champions him as the number one guy? It's fascinating.
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to throw – there's someone who I want to satisfy. He's been a long-time listener of this podcast, Caleb Baldwin, who I met in Dallas. I want to throw a couple of Impact Wrestling names at you because
– before you do, though, have you ever heard of the expression – and this is the one thing I think that's holding Roman Reigns back. Scared money don't make no money.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like WWE is always scared that they are going to push him too hard and he's going to be rejected, that it really gets in the way. They need to just put their heads down even more than they have and soldier forward with him now, because the rim is lowered for him right now after this, you know, deal where he came back from the cancer and, you know, has really received a lot of awful booking. And I think people are starting to really just like, you're fucking wasting this guy. Like, the rim is lowered right now. Please 360 slam dunk through the legs, Vince, please.
I hope that.
Stop being scared.
Yeah, absolutely. Please just unleash this guy. Play to his strengths. Let him be what he's best suited to be, whatever the hell that is. Just try, you know, try and give this guy a fair chance to fail on the big stage without handicapping him before he ever gets the opportunity, which is exactly, and that's hard to hold those WrestleMania main events against him, because the one with Triple H was Triple H's fault. The one with The Undertaker was The Undertaker's fault. Yep. And the one with Brock Lesnar was Brock Lesnar's fault. Yep. I mean, can you argue against that?
That's why I would like, you fix it all by booking him and Daniel Bryan.
Okay, so let's talk about these.
You give him a great match, you give him a great story, you give him, yeah, we can go forever on
and,
that.
And again, I mean, that's partly why he's one of the defining people of this generation. So, and it's a shame that we can't even comfortably put him in a number two spot. As crazy as that sounds, it's like you break down what the guy is versus what he's been booked to achieve on really a rare occasion. I mean, WrestleMania is four times per year, or four times over the last 4 years. Where's all the championship wins? Where's all the headlining attraction matches that went over well? Where's the great creative story that involves Roman Reigns? It's just not there. It's not there. Okay, yeah. Let's talk about these impact names, and we can rapid fire them, but I am curious.
Okay.
Let's talk about Brian Cage, who I love. God bless Brian Cage. I don't plan on watching Impact anytime soon. These other commitments are going to limit my wrestling watching, and I'm going to stick to AEW. But if Brian Cage shows up at any upcoming AEW show for the next year, I'm going to lose it. I love Brian Cage. To me, he's like this generation. He's got the potential to be this generation's Vader.
But he's like, his moveset's incredible. His athleticism is incredible. I think he's a perfect six man. Like, if you have Cage in there, he can jump as high as a two, but he can easily be a three. But like, if you have him as a six man, like if he's a Ginobili type, oh yeah, you've definitely got added value.
Because you'd want to see him against all of your top guys. I mean, you'd look forward to seeing him. And by the way, if you don't know who Brian Cage is, or if you're not familiar with what he can do, then basically he's a bigger version of John Cena, who can do everything that, I mean, you know how Cesaro is crazy athletic and can do all this stuff? Brian Cage is like...
And he does flips.
Brian Cage is like more athletic and about double Cesaro's size in terms of mass. And he's ripped to shreds. I've referred to him on Twitter as John Cena with coordination.
Lots of
coordination. He's incredible. Okay. Sami Callihan, who's the current Impact Wrestling World Champion. Very good character actor. Very interesting guy. But one who, you could see some Mick Foley parallels there in terms of the ability to communicate and to get across a more violent style of wrestling. No legacy whatsoever in WWE, building a legacy through unconventional means at this point.
Yeah. I'm admittedly not as familiar with, a lot of Sami Callihan's work. I did see the match he had with Tessa Blanchard, and I thought it was like fascinating. He did kind of fail out of WWE, but lots of people fail out of WWE, so I'm not going to hold that against him. Yeah, they gave him that hacker gimmick. It was horrible. I was there at the time, like at Full Sail, like, what is this? Like, so, I don't know. With Sami Callihan, he's obviously somebody's number one right now.
Like, if he stepped into AEW, what position do you think he would occupy? Because I think he would... I mean, because right now I think the guy who holds that spot is Jimmy Havoc. I think he'd be way bigger than Jimmy Havoc because he can talk like crazy. I mean, Sami Callihan can talk his butt off. So, you know.
I come in to let him fight Darby Allin.
I mean, that's not very high up the card. So, I mean, that doesn't say a whole lot about Sami Callihan. So, you mentioned Tessa Blanchard. Let's talk about the females for a minute because that's a topic that really... That wasn't a thing when I wrote the WrestleMania era book. You know what I mean? I mean, that just, it wasn't a thing. Mm-hmm. Trish Stratus made the first cut, but she was like ranked 87th out of 90. And that's the highest female ranking. So, you know, WrestleMania era, the Book of Sports Entertainment was very much a male dominated enterprise because let's face it, WWE historically is a male dominated enterprise, but females in the last 4 or 5 years have prominently entered this conversation. Tessa Blanchard is someone who is really making her way through at a very young age and is accomplishing things that no one's ever really accomplished at this level. So what do you think about Tessa Blanchard? And then I want to talk about the top WWE females for a moment.
So I think Tessa's a phenomenal case in the study of how people observe wrestling, right? Now, when you honestly talk about what Tessa Blanchard is doing as a business mover, it's really not anything at all, sure, right? But you see what she's doing creatively, and you see what she's doing as a wrestler. I've seen Tessa Blanchard wrestle in person several times at this point. Usually I've made it a point in the last two WrestleMania weekends to get to a card where I know she's having a big match. She had a match with Britt Baker at Shimmer, and this is the reason why I'm hesitant to write off Britt Baker, was because they had a 4-star match, like, and I saw it in person. I was there. I saw her wrestle, I think it was Mercedes Martinez. I saw her wrestle Deonna Purrazzo at Shimmer in New Orleans. She's flat out one of the most aggressive, talented wrestlers that are around, regardless of gender. Now, is she like an elite level, like Stardom worker? No. However, we're in the United States, and I think she, if she has the right platform, she's a number three. If she has the right platform,
because don't you feel like if she walks into AEW tomorrow, then the total trajectory of the way the AEW women's division is presented and is perceived changes almost overnight? That's the impression I get.
I think you get like social media looking at it a little differently. Like, okay, now in addition to like Statlander and, you know, a lot of these like new prospects that they're brought in, like, okay, a lot within the circle, Tessa's made already.
Yeah.
And credit to her for doing that in Impact.
Pretty impressive.
But, you know, and Impact has historically had the great women's division, right? But as an overall company, she's doing it in Impact. So.
Okay. So let's talk about a few more names, and then we'll wrap it up since we're getting pretty long here. Let's talk about some of the big hitters in the women's division in WWE. So particularly the names that jump to mind for me are Charlotte Flair and Becky Lynch. Because, to be honest, you know, I look at Sasha Banks and I see I think she's amazing. I think what she's done has been incredible. I'm very impressed with what she can do in the ring. I'm very impressed with the character that she's capable of portraying. But again, I mean, what her peak in terms of her character performance and what she can accomplish in the ring, I think happened when she was in NXT. And so the translation of that, the feud she had with Charlotte Flair when she was playing a natural foil to Charlotte Flair was, I thought, tremendous and a huge feather in her cap. And some of the stuff she did with Becky this year, I admittedly, I wasn't paying as close attention to it. I loved the match they had at Hell in a Cell this year. I thought it was one of the top five WWE matches all year. But Sasha Banks, to me, she's a sixth man at best.
Yeah, and I will agree with you on that. And there's a little bit of Chris Jericho there, I think, with Sasha. Never receiving the right portrayal, never getting the big wins when you need them. But having such a resume, a loyal fan base, a style among your that, you know, is no one's like Sasha Banks. Let's just put it out there. And then, you know, the robust NXT legacy, her being, you know, the tag team stuff, like, you know, they put those belts on her. I know they didn't do anything with them, but that's a function of a lot of the company. So I think Sasha naturally falls down on a lower tier than the other two that we're about to discuss, but it's not like it's like, hey, Sasha Banks wrestled her way into that position. No, I don't think there was a rung for her to grab necessarily.
Yeah, she's interesting because how do you contextualize the third best, the third greatest, we'll say, female wrestler? Arguably, those three are the top three ever. You know what I mean? I mean, Banks, Flair, Becky Lynch. I mean, at this point, I mean, Trish Stratus, as I demonstrated in over the summer in my little Women's World Cup tournament that I did, Legacy is very, very impressive. But I think what week to week and the consistency over the course of a long period of time that Sasha Banks, Becky Lynch, and Charlotte Flair has brought to the table really elevates them above all of their historical peers. But how do you contextualize the third greatest female in the overall product? That's something that's still sort of coming along. Becky Lynch is forcing us to have a conversation that's different about that. Let's leave her for last and let's just talk about Charlotte. Where do you see Charlotte? Because to me, she strikes me as a really solid number two.
I couldn't put Charlotte as a number two, and I'll tell you why. I could put Charlotte possibly as a three, and I say that because there's such a lack of a defining kind of character for her, to where her title history is largely now trying to rush her to 16 to get to Rick, and her big two reigns, like, she had them. She's got a little bit of that Randy Orton, to where the company wants you, the idea of you, I think, is actually greater than what you may have produced. She's had a really bad year this year, so maybe I'm not, you know, crediting her properly, but it's funny that she's kind of become like a topic lately with Corey Graves saying, like, you know, it feels like she's just kind of out there. And I felt like Charlotte's kind of been out there for a while now, while everyone's kind of, you know, become numb to her title wins and then the massive amounts of opportunities as compared to, like, I think if you give Sasha Banks Charlotte's opportunities, maybe we're talking about someone knocking on the door of number one, maybe. But it didn't go down like that.
That's true.
So, I think she's an incredible wrestler. I just don't feel comfortable putting her above Roman Reigns or like Daniel Bryan, or on even playing field with Roman Reigns or Daniel Bryan, because they've actually had to be in positions to draw and actually like produce week to week. And Charlotte's only been a part of like really one storyline like that. And these guys have at least done it multiple times.
So you don't think the Queen and that run she had opposite of Sasha Banks is her defining character?
No.
Okay. Fair enough.
And it's like she was ultimately a cheating heel wrestler there, and I don't feel like she transcended that. I felt like Sasha and her had that rivalry, and it shouldn't have ended the way it did. And it shouldn't have ended on the stage it did. It didn't pay off right. And I think they both have struggled to reach that level again until Charlotte and Becky really caught lightning in a bottle by a complete accident. So, and I don't know if, that feud could have been even better than it was. And it was pretty great.
Let me ask you this, and this is going to determine whether or not I go a little further down the Charlotte Flair rabbit hole. How interesting of a case do you think that Charlotte Flair can make for someone who's rapidly rising the WrestleMania era rankings? Because if you don't think that's an interesting case, we'll shut it down and move on to Becky Lynch. If you think that's an interesting case, I've got something to say about Charlotte Flair.
The only thing I can think with Charlotte now that would really solidify her as this, and she's going to get this anyway, like partly because of like the women that came before them never got the chance to do any of this stuff. So she's going to get held in a certain way. But for me, it's going to be how she transitions into the next stage of her career. Like, how can she cultivate, you know, a lot of the wrestlers around her? Can she be the Undertaker of women? Can she be the Triple H of women? Like, which one is she right now? That's what I'm trying to figure out. She's got two ways she can go. She can be Triple H and just fucking kill everybody, and then like they all come up and lose to Charlotte. Like, every time Asuka loses to Charlotte, a part of my soul dies. I feel like it can be that way for her, or it can be like, you know, one day she's gonna put over Toni Storm. One day she's going to put over Bianca Belair. One day she's going to put over Io Shirai or be in feuds with them. And I think that will only make Charlotte look better if she can get more. Like, she's going to have to do a lot more, I feel
like. Okay, fair enough. Well, let's go ahead and move on. And I'll you know, maybe if I'm on your podcast someday and Charlotte comes up, I'll bring up the other point I had.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Becky, because she's the glass ceiling shatterer, if there is such a thing anymore. I mean, she did get to the main event of WrestleMania. I mean, I think we all thought that was going to happen, but I don't think we thought it was going to happen by such an organic rise that sort of put her in that opportunity. That part was, you know, I think a lot of us thought Flair versus Rousey was going to main event last year's WrestleMania, and that probably was the penciled in plan as why Charlotte was shoehorned into it, even though she proved to be completely useless in that spot, and then you're never going to convince me otherwise. I mean, the one reason why she was put there supposedly was because she was going to make it a better match, but that didn't work out. So,
oh,
you know, I mean, but that said, you know, Becky Lynch, she forced her way into that, and it made it feel like the WrestleMania main event wasn't chosen for women because they were women, but that it was chosen for women because Becky Lynch was the man.
Yeah, and, you know, earlier in the show we said, like, by the time game day came, it felt like Kofi Kingston and Daniel Bryan was the hotter thing, right? But this was months and months and months, and then WWE undoing a lot of the good work that they did with, you know, them going on Twitter and saying the business is fake and all this other stuff that they did to completely just throw it down the shitter, essentially. But before that, the 10-week period between SummerSlam and Evolution was unlike it, or I won't say it's unlike anything. It's one of the great ones you've ever seen of someone taking themselves out of being a middling character into being the hottest person in the business. And flat out, that's what she was. She was the Wrestler of the Year in 2018 for WWE. Never seen a woman do that before. 2019, I think, has been a solidifying year for her. Like, all right, now you have the pressure. Now you're on the other side. You're not climbing the mountain. You are the mountain now, or you're on top of the mountain. So how can we build things around you? I think she was so interesting at a certain point. It's hard to bottle that interest and just be that way all the time. And I think she's getting some of that now, but she's still ultimately really popular, really over, you know, having a impact on moving ratings in a positive direction, which is something that wrestlers. Yeah. It's hard as hell to do for a lot of wrestlers these days. And she's actually having an impact. Like, you know, if you look at those quarter hour numbers that come out in like Wrestling Observer newsletter, for example, Becky's always doing well. And people want to see her, and people, you know, there are rivalries for her to have still. She's still got a long way to go, but she jetpacked herself.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like you have to credit her for that.
Oh, man. So where do you think she falls? Is she a solid number two who maybe can be a number one someday? I mean, obviously, because, I mean, she's the only female we've ever had that's been in a position to have a number one conversation.
I would think she's on at least I don't feel comfortable putting her over Roman Reigns, but I probably would put her like on par. And I know the for whatever reason, there was a weird energy between the Becky Lynch fans and the Roman Reigns fans last year. I don't know why, but there was. I think she's entrenched as a number three, right? For if she died tomorrow, uh-huh. Right? She's a number three. She could potentially go down as a high two, gotcha. I think. If they keep making the right moves with her, if they let her have the good matches, if they let her, you know, unleash on social media how she does and move. And she literally invented a way. I don't want to say invented a way to build a match because obviously they've built matches on social media before. But this is the first time it got put into a magnifying glass for the WrestleMania main event. And really, when she would air someone out on Twitter, it'd be like the subject of all my group chats. It would be like, hey, Becky's at it again, you know, and I think, you know, much like Charlotte. So if she takes that Undertaker route, like, hey, everyone's going to have to come through me or I'm going to kill everyone, it's going to determine where she can go.
Okay, so I think we've pretty much said Becky Lynch is a number two. So let's switch gears. I'm going to do a couple of rapid-fire ones with you real quick. Let's get your take on a few of these guys. Just, you know... Let's talk about, for instance, Juice Robinson in New Japan, who I'm a huge fan of after this year.
Juice is he's a guy that took control of his career. I would probably say he's a six man okay. right now.
What about Kota Ibushi?
Ibushi's a two. Okay.
Let's talk about Seth Rollins.
I think Rollins is a three. He's almost got like, you know, like if it came to Roman and Seth, who am I taking? I'm taking Roman personally. And I see Seth as like, you know, his little homie kind of. I would probably say he's a three.
Even though Seth Rollins, unlike Roman Reigns, has had basically an 18-month period where the product was built around him. I always talk about that part of his legacy because it's like it seems like in a lot of times when we're trying to talk about him in context, we're getting so caught up in the now that we forget. I mean, mm-hmm. when Daniel Bryan went down and Seth Rollins turned on the Shield, from that point until November of the next year, Seth Rollins was the undisputed number one guy on TV every week on Raw. And for a big chunk of that time, it carried.
Maybe it just doesn't feel like it. Like maybe it doesn't feel like it because like when every big four would come, where would he be? It would be like, you know, I think he was in the Survivor Series match. He may have been WrestleMania and, 2015, he was, you know, fighting Randy Orton, and then they did the cash in. They had him in the middle at WrestleMania or SummerSlam 2015 for The Undertaker, and I don't know. I think they made him like such a weak champion where like clouds, like, you know, because there was a time where he lost 19 matches in a row as the champion, like. I don't even know what to do with that. Like,
when did that happen?
It was, I think, in September through October of 2015, if I'm not mistaken.
19 matches where, though?
And it was like 19 matches on between house shows, TV, and pay-per-view.
Huh. Interesting.
I was like, what are they doing here? Like, I don't, it was weird. And I think around that time, Seth Rollins would save himself on pay-per-view after having to, you know, either lose on TV or made it look crazy on TV. He used to have to do a lot of recuperating on pay-per-view, which he would do then.
I would argue Seth Rollins is too.
The thing is, this year was so tragic for him. I don't think he's ever been like someone that has been over to the level of like where like there's no Daniel Bryan peak.
No,
right?
No way. Yeah.
There's no big business behind him in any company. Like, it seems like he kind of comes after whatever's been set for him, and he can hold it in place, kind of. But I don't know if that's a function of just him being in the right place at the right time. I don't know what it is. But and this year was a tragedy for him. No way to slice it.
Well, the last quarter of it, certainly, yeah.
Like, the Baron Corbin stuff went horribly. And I know there's only so much you can ask for him to do in that situation, but yo, like, this was a rough year for him. Like, and I think maybe him turning the heel, maybe he can reclaim some of that. But I'm not ready to make him.
Gotcha. I think because he's been the most consistently pushed wrestler of this generation. I mean, no one else really even comes close. I mean, Seth Rollins has sort of been the one guy who, year in and year out, they're building stories around Seth Rollins. They're not building, it's not just, okay, well, he's going to face this guy, you know, the whole thing with Ambrose, that was, I think that's his defining rivalry, but the way things broke for him when he came back and he had the match with Roman, the run he had as a heel after turning on the Shield, I mean, I look back at that, that's his run toward the end of 2015, is pretty much, that's the last vestiges of my personal vested interest in WWE as a product before I started to get increasingly jaded with it. It's a solid three. I think, what do you think his ceiling is? I think that's one of those interesting conversations about, you know, is his ceiling like a poor man's Chris Jericho? Or is his ceiling a very poor man's Triple H? And we'll look back.
I think he's a very, very poor man's Triple H. And, like, it just didn't work as a babyface. And it should have, because he had the moveset. He had – I just think people just didn't get into him. That, like as a – there was, like, nothing to – like, what is an architect? Like, what is a – what his nickname became everyone who he beat. It was like, what is a Beast Slayer? Like, oh, you beat Brock Lesnar in a fake match. Like, I just think people just largely weren't fascinated by him. He didn't capture them on a level like a Daniel Bryan did, or like a CM Punk, or it's like he's almost, I don't want to say he's like the, like a creative wrestler kind of from like the indie scene. Like the idea, I've always talked about the idea of Seth Rollins always kind of standing out more than Seth Rollins. And I just feel like there are better examples of guys who have either done it before him at a higher level than him that have too many like similar backgrounds than him. And that either A, broke down and couldn't last, you know, whether physically or something with the company. And he was either smart enough to navigate it, you know, to navigate it politically and be young enough. So maybe, I don't know. That's something we got to always go back and examine. So I think from here, his potential, I think he can be a high two. It's going to involve him having great matches again, though. Like, he's going to have to re-enter the world class because it's been a while.
Best thing going for him right now is that they went with the Tide. They went with the Tide that the crowd wanted them to go with, and that's not something that happens that often. So just as much as we always talk about that happening for people who people really, really want to cheer, that can also be the same case for people who they really want to boo. So they're playing into that, and that's going to give them the platform, hopefully, to get to maybe help us recontextualize the babyface part of his career to the masses in particular. Like I think a lot of people think of Triple H's babyface runs. Okay, so let's rapid fire through a few more, and then I want to close on two names in particular that I think are really going to be some of the bigger ones that we'll talk about based on AEW's success. I want to get your take on, let's talk about quickly, let's go with Pac. Where do you see him right now, and what do you think he could be?
I think Pac can be a three seed. Yep. And I think he's a number three guy. And I think he's a low three right now. Like you have to, like, what we talked about earlier in the show is like contextualizing like worldwide. What he did for the Dragon Gate title earlier this year and, you know, some of last year, it made a new star. It created a new guy. It protected the belt. It, you know, that stuff is stuff that you can't just like throw it on and be like, oh, it was on this small scale, so it doesn't count. So he was an ace there. So if you can be an ace in a smaller company like that, kind of like Tessa Blanchard, I said, yeah, it's an impact and she's doing these things, but that would at least slot you on a lower tier in a higher company. So I think Pac is at least a 3 right now.
Okay, let's close then by talking about two of the big legacy people that I think, you know, Jericho, we talked about at length earlier about what AEW is going to mean to him, what's it's going to mean to his career, is the potential to break into that number one sort of category. No question, number two, a guy who can be a number one, and if so, is all of a sudden now he's a bona fide top 10 all-time guy. There's no getting around it anymore. He's not on the fringe anymore. He's there. Two guys that come to mind who also stand to gain a lot from AEW's success and who would stand to lose a lot from AEW's failure, because Chris Jericho is exempt from that conversation, I think. Number one is Jon Moxley. Jon Moxley stands to gain a lot from AEW working its way up in the next couple of years and having a huge, you know, let's say they do get that big WrestleMania type thing going. They figure out a way to create whatever the version of that would be in this day and age, which I think, by the way, one thing that you might could do that might create something like that is if you find a way to mix and match all the other top companies in the world outside of WWE under the AEW platform. So let's say you were able to get Kota Ibushi over here. Let's say you were able to bring over a Kazuchika Okada and put him up against on their stage in front of, you know, let's say hypothetically they do a huge show in Jacksonville Jaguar Stadium. Let's say they do that, or they do it someplace in Chicago during the late summer where it would be feasible to do it outside. And they bring in New Japan stars, and they bring in the biggest stars from Mexico, and they do that type of thing. That being said, that's something to explore. But Jon Moxley, if he's prominently involved in something like that, and this company really takes off, the run on TNT isn't fleeting, Jon Moxley's really going to be looked at in a completely different light. Right now, I would look at him as someone who you'd be hard-pressed to say he's anything, you know, six-man. It was where he was, I think, at worst, third guy. Does he have the chops to be a number two?
Yes.
Let's find out. But,
yes.
I mean, that's...
Yeah. And I think he's going to get the chance that, like, I know for sure he's going to get the chance that I don't know that Rollins and Roman are going to get that chance to get, because he's 33 years old. We saw when he went to New Japan, he was insanely over this summer and did an excellent job, insanely motivated. And he's got something pushing him that those other guys don't. Because he's got a big contract, presumably in AEW, but he's also got the weight of if it fails, oh no, then either I'm going to have to get on an airplane and go to Japan all the time, or eventually I'm going to go back to WWE. And if he ever goes back, they're never going to treat him the same way that they did. And I think that pressure is going to cause him to reach for his greatness that is inside of him. This year has been a year that Jon Moxley proved a lot of what fans think about WWE, proved a lot of what people thought about him wasn't necessarily true, because he can go out there and work really hard and wrestle really hard, do different style matches, and be a top star that he knows he is. He's oddly in the Austin position, you know, going from, like, you know, into WWE, like, they got this guy that's hungry as hell that's just been, he's in the middle of his prime, got kind of jerked around, it feels like, and somehow hit the open market, and you bring him in, you never know how what the feeling can be. And Ross is trying really hard to frame him as the Austin of this thing. So I don't know if it's going to work. But I feel like he's been creatively maximized so far.
There's going to be a lot for him to do here. There's going to be this run he's on right now, whatever peak it could reach. Maybe it's becoming champion. I'd be very curious if I was AEW to test out just how strong a draw he can be by building this match with Jericho for quite a while and putting it on the main event of a TV show at some point too, and saying like maybe doing the rematch after this next pay-per-view in February on TV mm-hmm. with a really strong hook behind it, maybe a month's worth of build, and see what kind of rating it pops. Seeing if it could pop a rating. Because I'm anxious to see yeah. that part of his career evolve. Is what is he going to be able to do from that side of things? How much of a draw can he be toward AEW? Because there's a lot of guys who had success in WWE to an extent. There's a lot of guys that had success outside of WWE to great success. Jericho's obviously the pinnacle of the guys they've got who have done things, but a close second to that is Ambrose. I mean, Ambrose was around for long enough to be in that conversation like we're having about Seth Rollins. It doesn't, yeah, big part of his legacy, of course, was that he did not get to maximize what he could be, but that's a legacy for all of those guys right now. Now he steps into a place where it's put up or shut up time. You've got the opportunity to maximize what you can be. Once this thing with Jericho, the babyface run, has run its course, we still have not seen Moxley as the heel. We always fantasized about that as WWE fans. When he gets that opportunity to unleash as a villain, what's he going to do? He's got to have ideas that have been building up for the better part of a decade on how to execute that and how to maximize that part of himself. All of those things are on the table for him in AEW. If he hits it out of the park, what do you think he's got to accomplish in AEW to enter into a conversation where we're talking about him as not just a number two, but a number two within the context of the guys we talked about earlier as being number twos? You know, guys like who was a great number two we talked about? We talked about Eddie Guerrero as a number two. We talked about Edge as a number two. We talked about Kurt Angle as a number two. What's he got to do to join that class?
I think he has to continue to load up on the great matches. And then with those great matches are going to come opportunities for the business side. Can AEW, you know, get that next TV deal? Can they eventually start moving those pay-per-view numbers forward? Can they eventually get into a stadium show? These are all things I think you're going to look at. And if Moxley is in positions, in a top three position on any of those, you know, things consistently, I think you have to start taking him and reevaluating where he was and where he ultimately will be.
I think the same thing that I'm about to say about Moxley also applies to the last guy I want to talk about, which is Cody Rhodes. If we're sitting here next August or the following August and AEW runs a stadium show, you know that they had 100,000, you know, people in the queue or whatever it was. They could have done that.
Well, it was the ticket demand.
Yeah, the ticket demand is there to do a stadium show, right?
If they build it up, I think the people will come.
So they've got that potential there. Let's say he's in the main event of that show, and that show does 200,000 pay-per-view buys in an era where nobody buys wrestling pay-per-views in that kind of number anymore. That's a big feather in his cap. That's a huge feather in his cap. And if that company then goes on to build on that success, then John Moxley's a guy we talk about as a real game changer in wrestling history, right?
Yeah. No question. Like, you talk about leaving one company to help build another. I think that's the biggest thing for Jericho, was propping him up to a no question number one for me now. Is like, you went and did it in New Japan, now you're doing AEW. People, like, they will hold the 20 years of being in WWE, or the 18 years of being in WWE, as like your definition, but they will be not getting the total picture.
Well, last but not least, man, and this is going to be the last topic we talk about here on the Doc Says on the final episode of this show.
Man.
Cody Rhodes. I mean, he's already a game changer. Already. How high can this guy climb? Because, I mean, one thing I'd like to go back and put in context is, I mean, we talked earlier about undisputed number one guys. Conspicuous by his absence in that conversation was his father. You know? Not a huge WrestleMania era in-ring talent per se, but definitely during Ric Flair's peak, Dusty Rhodes is a part of what builds to that peak. So, and then obviously the behind-the-scenes stuff, you've got the legacy of what he did or didn't do in WWE. What's Dusty Rhodes to you? Just WrestleMania era, not looking at all the influence.
I would say Dusty's a solid two.
Gotcha. And that makes sense, I think, for sure.
Yeah, Dusty's solid two, and if you're in a pinch, he can maybe moonlight as a one for
you. All right, so what's Cody got the potential to be? Because right now, with what he's done, how can you say he's anything but a two?
Yo, that's crazy. Like, because, look, it's not a secret that I've not been the most ardent Cody Rhodes supporter here, because I think he's largely underwhelming and tropey in the ring. However, what he has with the fans right now, a lot of wrestlers never have that. I've never seen fans feel about Roman Reigns how they feel about Cody Rhodes right now. I've never seen them feel like Seth Rollins, or that way for Seth Rollins. I've never seen them feel that way for Jon Moxley. I've never seen, the way he's speaking to people, and what he's doing is so basic, but they just love him, and it boils down to that. Like, you have to be holding your eyes shut to not see it right now. And is he the smoothest wrestler? Hell no. Like, you can look at some of the stuff in his matches and be like, why are these people going crazy over this? I don't understand it.
Has he ever hit a disaster kick? Has he ever landed one of those?
Like, it just feels, there's something weird with how he jumps. Like, he's just not a great, like, he is a great athlete, but he's not a spectacular athlete. I'll say that. And it's just like, yo, people just love him. Maybe it just comes down to that. And then they see him as the beacon that is helping put a lot of this stuff together. And I think he's a two right now. And I would never have said this as recently as April 2018. Would have never said that.
How could you? Yeah, I mean, this is a very recency bias argument, but it's hard to deny it.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's fitting that I'm going to talk with Floyd, who's the biggest Cody fan after this. But eventually he will be the champion in AEW. And the way they're going to do it, like, there's an old school angle behind this that is going to work, and people will accept it. I'm saying it now. And I think he's got so much to gain. It's all, like, everything's on the table for him if it goes right, including a number one.
I agree, and that's where I was going next, is I think Cody Rhodes is a rare guy who's got the ability to parlay this into into making himself. And it's weird. I mean, and we've got to eventually reconcile the fact that the in-ring stuff is going to have to be there. Now, I mean, I personally have loved his last two, well, not his last two, but two out of his three pay-per-view matches in 2019 I thought were great. Like, I know you weren't as big a fan of the Jericho match as I was. I appreciate the old-school flavor that he brings. And that and the match with Dustin Rhodes, considering just how engaged the audience is in these moments, it's an experience, a Cody Rhodes match is right now, in whatever way that it needs to be. That's the thing. He's the heart and soul of this company. He's got his finger on the pulse of the AEW and really the wrestling fan base at large. He just gets it. So, you know, if he can parlay this into, we talked about earlier, Ric Flair being the beacon of the NWA, Cody Rhodes is the beacon of AEW, and if he goes on and puts together a resume, considering that his age is, what, 33? I mean, yeah. He's got the whole prime of his career. He was underutilized in WWE. There were times where he didn't do diddly squat, you know?
There were times his WrestleMania match got cut.
I mean, it was never someone who had to go out there and wrestle for, you know, 30 minutes I don't know that he ever wrestled for 30 minutes in WWE unless it was on a house show. So, I mean, we're talking about a guy who should have every advantage right now to get to that level if he can do it. And that's going to be one of those things that this is partly why I chose AEW. I sat there watching the December 11th episode, the one where Cody faced the Blade and the Butcher for the first time, and I'm just watching this whole show play out, and I'm just, the feeling I get when I watch this show is this company is affording these wrestlers a platform to showcase who they can be at their best. That's, and even if that's not the case with everybody, and it's not, of course, but it is giving people a platform to do all the things we talked about on a macro level with WrestleMania, on a micro level. I mean, it's just week in and week out, my investment in this company's success. I can't wait to see what we end up talking about with Pac over the next 2 to 3 years, if he's there that long. I can't wait to see what happens with Cody Rhodes and Moxley, Kenny Omega, who we didn't really even put in this kind of conversation. You know, all of these guys, I want to see what they can do. Because if AEW becomes to this generation what even the NWA was in the 80s and what WCW was before the Monday Night Wars, then we're going to take them seriously in any big picture conversation about wrestling lore. So, you know, if Cody Rhodes can be at the forefront of that and do it for a long time and continue to maintain his place with the audience, then it's going to be hard to keep him from maximizing his success and being that big of a star. I'm really rooting for it. I think it's going to be a really amazing thing to watch that play out. So, brother, it has been...
We've reached the
end of the road, and it has been a pleasure. It truly has been. So it's not going to be a whole long-winded goodbye here, But yeah, man, I've always enjoyed talking to you. This was a really great conversation, to be honest with you. I will count this among my favorite conversations that I've ever had about wrestling, and I hope that it comes across that way, that you bore with us for this better part of 3 hours, ladies and gentlemen. And, you know,
man,
this is the longest podcast that I've ever done, so I appreciate Rich being on board with it and sticking with me through the whole thing. So,
plug your stuff,
brother, while you are here. Let's get One Nation Radio hyped. Talk about Social Suplex, and let them know where the legacy will continue.
No doubt, man. I'm gonna try to keep carrying it on from a lot of stuff that Chad has championed, and with me and James on One Nation Radio. We're on the Social Suplex Podcast Network, of course. We're going to be changing hosts shortly. We're going to be going over from Podbean to Red Circle. So there's a way where those of you that are subscribed right now, nothing will change for you because we're going to swap some RSS links. But there are going to be, you know, more ways for you guys to help contribute to the show and things of that nature. And Check out my YouTube channel. I do music as well. And, you know, as you guys have heard on this show for the better part of like 3 years,
at least.
And also Chad's, you know, song, the song for his book, The Greatest Matches and Rivalries of WrestleMania Era. You can stream that on any streaming service. I would appreciate it. And, you know, just check out Social Suplex. Follow me on Twitter at RichLatta32. And thank you to Chad, man. Thank you for always, you know, like we had the, you know, thank you and everything last year when you said you were going to walk away. But I, you know, you're always a cool guy. You're always, you know, looked out and definitely always, you know, championed, you know, my perspective and, you know, been a champion of James and I and always give, you know, for how much you've given to the wrestling community, like, and as far as your conversation, the way you've approached things, it's something to definitely, like, you know, if you guys are listening to this and you want to, you know, do wrestling podcasts, you want to pursue writing and things like that, there's a lot, you know, of people you can look at, but one of them I would recommend is look at what Chad did. So look at how he, you know, turned his writing SmackDown reviews for Fridays into eventually, you know, column work and into a radio show, into being published not twice but three times. He's done it all. So if this is the end, like he says it is, I think he's going out, you know, a champion. You know.
Well, thank you for saying all that, man. That sounds like a great way to bring the Doc Says era and the Doc Chad Matthews era, for that matter, to a close. I think most of you, if you want to find me beyond this, it'll be the random Twitter post here and there. But I'm gonna do what I said I was gonna do and didn't actually do when I retired in 2018 out of disgust. Now I'm in a really good place, so I'm gonna go back and try to be just a fan who watches the product. I'm gonna go back to a little bit more of a simpler life as a wrestling fan for a while, and I'm sure something will spark my ridiculous enthusiasm to, you know, touch base with Rich and be like, hey, can I come on the podcast and talk about wrestling? And
open an invite.
And we'll see what happens. But it's been a pleasure with you, Rich. It's been a pleasure with all of you. Please check out all of the great podcasts across the Social Suplex Network, across the Chair Shot Radio Network, across Lords of Pain Radio. It's been an honor. It's been a privilege. And so for the final time for Rich Latta, this has been the Doc Chad Matthews. Thank you very much. Doc says,
this is just what the doc ordered. I'm saying welcome. They sick of the other shows. Chad here to help them. The author of the Mania Era is bringing terror on radio. This is the purveyor for the knowledge that he about to showcase. Like a bar that you lift, his opinions hold weight. He wrote a few books and he's working on another for y'all. This a 5-star podcast. Chad, let's get it on.
Author of the WrestleMania